On today's program, our topic will be man's inhumanity toward man. Denny Luna speaks with Henry Friedman, founder of the Washington State Holocaust Education Center in Seattle, Washington. Here's Denny on this encore edition of Like It Is.
Thank you, Bob. On this edition of Like It Is, I'm pleased to speak with Henry Friedman, who is the founder of the Washington State Holocaust Education Resource Center. Mr. Friedman is a survivor of the Holocaust, and I started out by asking him why he founded the center.
I originally recruited four teachers to go on a program to Israel to study about the Holocaust. And I got myself involved more and more, and I found the need to have a resource center for the teachers available in order to learn about the Holocaust. And the purpose of that is to make people understand what happened that time and to prevent future injustice to people. It isn't just that I am so scared to have another Holocaust. What happened to Rodney King, to me, is a crime by itself, by a crime where you have a human being being mistreated and you have law officers that's sworn to obey the law, standing, not the one exactly that just did the beating, but having a police officer standing and doing nothing and watching the beating of a human being. If we can teach young people that this is wrong, we can prevent future inhumanity to other human beings. And this is my main purpose.
It's interesting that you mentioned Rodney King. A few weeks ago on this program, we had an interview with a man who founded a Black Holocaust Museum. It basically chronicled black lynchings in this country. So you do see a parallel between racism and anti-Semitism.
Yes, but you know, what I don't like when people use the word Holocaust to compare it to other genocides. See, Holocaust is unique in itself because it addresses a people that were doomed to die for one reason only, that they were born to a certain religion. So therefore, I think we use the word Holocaust very vaguely and shouldn't be used. Genocide is something else. But yes, there is a parallel between anti-Semitism and racism, absolutely.
Let's talk about your story because I think it is fascinating, at least to me. You survived the Holocaust by basically hiding out. Can you tell me a little bit about your experience, how old you were, how you hid?
When I went into hiding, it was in 1942, in October of 1942. I was at that time 14 years old. I found myself in an area up in a loft above animals. Animals were below me. It was a house. The half of the house where the people lived, they were hiding us. Another half of that house, they had their animals. And we were up in the loft above the animals. Our space was, if you can visualize, a queen-size bed. And it was a V-shaped roof. So we were in the edge of the roof, not in the middle, but kind of reached out almost to the middle of it. And it was myself. I had a younger brother. And my mother and a teacher, a Jewish teacher that we adopted. And the way we were sleeping, myself, my brother, facing one way, and my mother and the teacher facing the opposite way. But we were in the same covers. And the only thing we could do in that space is either sit up or lay down. There was not enough room for me to stand up. The only one that could stand up was my younger brother in a certain area near the chimney. And we were surrounded, the whole thing was kind of camouflaged, with hay. So the whole upper loft was full with hay. And we were in that special small area. And the way the food would be sent up to us was through a special opening. Originally, when we got up there, I never forget, it was very, very dark. It was probably the darkest night that I ever experienced in my life when we disappeared from existence. But when morning came, the only light that we got in was through cracks, because there was no light coming in otherwise. And there was a wood paneling kind of in front of us at the edge of that building. And we saw there was a nut in the wood paneling. And we kind of started working on it. And after a few days, we got that nut out. And we got, I don't know, maybe a little bigger than, maybe like a dollar-sized hole opening. And you'd be surprised when you're used to darkness how much light a little hole like this would give you to that area. And we got that hole. But it also opened up to me as a healthy young person the pain where I could watch the outside, because we were up on a hill and we could kind of watch the village. We were also near a road and watch young people playing. And here I was cooped up without being able to speak a loud word. All we could do just whisper, and only whisper at a certain time. I did, otherwise use sign language, and not being able to stand up or do anything. Little did I know at that time how long I would be stuck in that area.
How long were you there?
Almost 18 months, 17 and a half months.
And then the war ended, is that?
No, the war did not end. We were liberated by the Russian army that liberated that particular village, and we were set free at that time. And that was in 1944, in March of 1944.
What were your thoughts when you were up in that loft? How did you sustain yourself to last that 18 months?
That's a very good question. When I think back, at that time, we had the Bible. My father was a very religious person, and we prayed a lot. We prayed a lot, and when I think about it, it gave us, by praying, it gave us hope. However, after liberation, I believed there was no God. I mean, I just couldn't believe there was a God, and there was a God. How could he allow something like this to happen? Even during the hiding, I had questions also. But since I didn't have any better answers, this was one way to sustain. Also, since we weren't getting very much food, it's just to hope and pray that one day we will get enough food to satisfy our hunger. And then maybe we didn't care what would happen. And there were third thoughts, is to be a witness to what happened, to be able to tell the story. And when I used to talk to my little brother and tell him, someday we'll have children, maybe we'll tell the story, and he would say, nobody would believe it. It was just unbelievable what was happening.
Tell me a little bit about why you think Hitler rose so quickly to power, and why people didn't stop him.
Because people, again, I'm saying this, you know, looking backwards, back now, and from the historical point of view. At that time, there was lots of unemployment in Germany. It was chaos. He was a good speaker. As you know, like we say, who gets elected even in many other countries is people that can communicate well and are handsome or, you know, something like this, where voters go by. But in those days, how did you get the information is through listening in on the radio. And he came across very well. He could communicate, like I said, very well. There was lots of unemployment. He made promises to them three. You see where people say the Democrats are bad, the Republicans are bad, but here comes Perot that nobody knows anything about, but because he was a successful businessman, people are leaning, he's new, he's outside, he's coming in, let's vote for him. Or you take right here when you have a person like Dave Duke was running for the governor of New Orleans, where, you know, it's scary again, where you have 67% of the white votes went for him. Now, you know he's a racist. You know he is also anti-Semite. We know that because he said the Holocaust never happened. And yet people did vote for him because he was a communicator. He could communicate with people. And this is a danger. We have to look inside. People didn't read Mein Kampf, that Hitler published. Then they would have known what he was all about. People don't want to see, human beings, we want to see the good in everybody because we try to be good. And therefore, as a human being, you can't see the bad until it's too late sometimes. Because we want to believe in the good. So the people believed in Hitler. He wasn't as bad. I remember as a kid overhearing conversation in my house about what Hitler was doing to the Jews. And you always thought, well, it's a little bit exaggerated. Because very seldom we had first-hand information on what was happening. We knew he was bad. We knew he was bad. But we couldn't believe as bad as he really was.
So there was a lot of denial, maybe even denial that the...
You don't want to believe. You don't want to believe. To this day, you know, if you tell me that this so-and-so is bad or something like this, I don't believe you. I will never believe you. I have to encounter that person and talk to that person to find out if that's true. And that's what the average human being is.
One thing I've wondered is why people stood by and then why others helped families like you. Do you have any explanation for that?
It's another good question because I have no explanation for it except in 1989, I brought the lady that was really responsible for me being alive today. I brought her to America. And when she was interviewed on TV, and she was asked, why did you do what you did, risk your life? And she said, how could I not? So here was a person, she just didn't know. She reacted to the situation. But yet you wonder, why were there so few? Again, you know, it comes out the animal in the human being. I know I was in India when Mrs. Gandhi got killed. I happened to be in New Delhi at that time. It happened to be the day when she was murdered. And I happened to be in a place called Khajuraho. 2 or 3 days later, where I saved a Sikh's life because he was going to be killed. He was 24 years old, and for only one reason, because he was a Sikh and because two Sikhs killed Mrs. Gandhi. And that was the reason to kill him, you know, and I personally feel very satisfied because I saved that man's life with my own experience to convince the people that they shouldn't kill him just because he's a Sikh. But before that killing, I was traveling through India with my wife and learning about the Hindu religion. I thought, oh, now this is a beautiful religion. They love everybody, and everybody's like a human being. But then when I saw the killing of Sikhs, I realized being is worse than an animal under certain conditions. We behave worse than animals because animals only kill to eat when they are hungry, where human beings sometimes kill just for the fun of killing.
Right. I don't think any one race or one religion really has a monopoly on cruelty.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And that's what I learned traveling in India because I've traveled all over the world. I've been almost in every continent. I've been to Africa. I've been to China. And I've seen all kinds of different cultures. If you learn the history, human beings can become animals, worse than animals.
certainly in contemporary times, some of the same issues that we faced in the 1940s are still around, including the denial of the Holocaust itself, the rise of racist skinheads in Germany and the United States. Is this kind of a surprising development for you? That
surprise? Absolutely. I never expected that in my lifetime there'll be these Holocaust deniers saying the Holocaust didn't happen. I mean, the only thing that I can see them being is anti-Semites, looking for our avenue, A, to expand on their old historical anti-Semitic hatred for the Jews. And this is one avenue, plus they profit from it, because there's always people that are willing to give them money to expand on that, and there's people that live with hate inside that they can recruit to a cause like that. This is one thing, you know. I mean, the only deniers, in my, people that say the Holocaust didn't happen, which is, you know, a factual thing, we have all the historical evidence, and I'm still alive that I can tell the facts, because I saw it, what happened. If the Holocaust didn't happen, what happened to my 180 close relatives that I had before the war? Where are they now? There's not even tombstones for most of them. They're all dead. I mean, to say such a thing. So we know why they're doing it. You know, when I appear, especially with students, when I speak to students, and when I tell them, the question is, do you hate? Always. You must hate Hitler and things like that. And when I say, no, I don't hate, because hate is a terrible thing. Don't be indifferent, because you can make a difference. When you see wrong, don't be a standby and do nothing. Step in there. Face the person that's trying to do wrong or trying to say wrong. Correct them on these statements. Don't be passive. As coming out of the Holocaust, I blame even America for being indifferent what was happening at that time, because they could have stopped by education that I think we can stop in the future, I hope.
Let's hope for a better tomorrow. Thank you very much for your words. We've been speaking today with Mr. Henry Friedman, the founder of the Washington State Holocaust Education Resource Center. The center's located in Seattle. And now back to you, Bob.
Thanks, Denny. Denny with Henry Friedman, a Holocaust survivor and founder of the Washington State Holocaust Education Resource Center. Next week, Denny will interview Professor Christopher Browning, author of Ordinary Men. The book previews why people carried out the killing of Jews in World War II. A regular feature of Like It is short stories by Tom Watson. Tom brings us a series of short stories from the Village Gate.
I am here to entertain you a little bit and warm you up. You need some warming up. In order to stretch your imagination a little bit and allow you to fully participate with us tonight, I have brought you some stories. The first of those is about Mullah Nasruddin. Nasruddin is a composite character from the Middle East, and he's the kind of everyman that everything happens to. Sometimes he pulls wonderful things out of impossible situations, and other times he seems to create chaos by his very presence. Well, one day, the town philosopher came to Nasruddin's home to debate with him about philosophy and things of the world. But when he got to Nasruddin's gate and knocked on the door, he found that nobody was home. In anger, he picked up a piece of chalk and scrawled on the side of Nasruddin's gate, "Stupid oaf," with a big exclamation point, and left, went home. A few hours later, when Nasruddin returned home and saw the name on the gate, right away he remembered who he had a meeting with, and he went directly to his home and he said, "I apologize for not having been home when you came to call. But as soon as I saw that you had left your name on the gate, I remembered the meeting. Shortly after that, the townspeople decided that they wanted to have Nasruddin preach a sermon because, you know, Mueller is kind of a clergyman of some kind, and they wanted to hear what this clergyman had to say. So they arranged for him to preach on Friday, which in that part of the world is the day of service and prayer. Nasruddin came in, he walked up to the pulpit, he looked out over the congregation and opened with, "Who of you know of that which I am about to speak?" Well, naturally, nobody said anything. In indignation, he said, "Well, if you're so ignorant that you don't know anything about what I'm about to address, I haven't time for you," and got down and went home. Now, they wouldn't give up with one. So they came back to Nasruddin and asked him again the next week if he would preach, and he agreed. He went up again to the pulpit on Friday, the day of prayer. He looked out over the congregation and said, again, "Who of you in this congregation knows of that which I am about to speak?" Now, they remembered last week. So everybody said, "I do, I do." Nasruddin said, "Well, if you already know what I'm about to tell you, I shouldn't bother." And he got down and went home. Now, not to be outdone, the congregation asked him to preach again the third week in a row. And when he came up to the pulpit that Friday, they thought they were ready for him. He looked out over the congregation, "Who of you know of that which I am about to speak?" Half the congregation said, "We do." Half said, "We don't." Without missing a beat, Nasruddin said, "Wonderful. Those of you who do, tell those of you who don't." And he got down and went home. On another day, Nasruddin was traveling back and forth between Iran and Egypt. And he began to do this every week. And you know, there's a border and he had to pass customs. And the customs inspector said, "What are you carrying back and forth?" And Nasruddin, without hesitation, said, "I'm a smuggler." They examined the donkey that he was riding on. They examined the big bags that he had. They found nothing that he was smuggling. Week after week, month after month, Nasruddin continued to do this. And he grew more prosperous in appearance until he finally retired. Later, the customs inspector also retired, and one day, walking through the streets of Cairo, spotted Nasruddin. He said, "Hey, fellow, you were going back and forth across the border week after week after week, saying that you were a smuggler, and we never could determine what it was you were smuggling. Now that you are out of harm's way, please tell me." "I was smuggling donkeys." Stories are short or long, funny or serious, and it takes a good mixture of stories of different kinds to be good entertainment for an audience such as you. So I'll move now from those that were short and funny to one that is short but will pull on your emotions a little bit. All of us know a little bit about baseball, and most of us have participated in some fashion in Little League baseball. That's what this story is about. Last Little League season, young David and his father came to every game arm in arm, and they would walk up to the front row of the bleachers where father would sit while David played occasionally, but usually sat on the bench. With only 2 weeks left in the season, young David's father died. So David came to the next game alone. He went up to the coach, explaining, "Coach, my father died last week, and I know I haven't been playing very well this season, but it's important that I play today. Please let me start." The coach, in sympathy for the young man, agreed, let him start, and David played a magnificent game. He had 3 hits. He was catching balls in the field that nobody other than he could have caught that day. And he stole 4 bases. His team won. He was the most valuable player. The coach came out, greeted David on the field. "David, that was a wonderful game you've played today." But you've never, ever played like that before. Why today? Well, coach, said David, you know that my father died last week. What you may not have realized is that Dad was blind. Today was the first game that he has ever seen me play. Moving to another part of the world, there was a little Japanese boy who decided to leave home. During the day, the first day that he left home, he was walking through the streets and looking at the stalls and looking at people's wares and talking with the townsfolk. He was happy and comfortable. But when nightfall came, he found himself in a heavily wooded area, and it was completely dark. The young man was afraid of the dark, so frightened that he soon began to shake and cry and sat down on the ground, feeling sorry for himself and unhappy that he had left home. About the time that he was at wit's end, a glimmering light appeared up in the sky, and that light caught his eye. When he looked up, it came down and touched the ground in front of him and then formed itself into stairs. Now, this curious young man began to walk up those stairs. The higher he got, the lighter he felt, until he had to hold on to the stairs to keep from floating away. He continued to climb higher and higher until his curiosity got the better of him, and he looked down to see how high he was, and the height frightened him. He forgot that he was holding on to the stairs. When he let go, he started to float up, up above the clouds. He floated up so high that he could actually see the curve of the earth. It was then that that young boy realized that he had within himself the power to go wherever he chose, to be whatever he chose. He just needed to look for the light and let go.
Short stories by Tom Watson. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.